Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
I expect that some, or maybe even many of you, may be surprised at the title of my talk or even skeptical of it. After all, isn't it clear from the news, from the internet, from virtually any number of sources, that there is an ongoing conflict or warfare between science and faith? Well, you would not be entirely wrong to think that way, but there's a lot more to be said, which is sort of what I'm going to be saying for the next 40 minutes or so. As a historian, I'm interested in what I might call the long view of things, and so my question is this. If we believe that there is a war between science and faith, one, how did it come to be? And two, what are its foundations and its origins? Well, the conflict is often presented to us today as something inevitable and eternal, arising out of various incommensurabilities between science and faith. But what I hope to show you this evening is that this state of affairs is, first of all, a very recent development, and two, its foundations rest not upon historical realities, but upon social, political, and personal agendas on the one hand, and upon needless theological missteps on the other. Well, the place to start is for me to say very clearly that the conflict or warfare model for the historical interaction of science and religion has been rejected by every serious historian of science. Period. Every serious historian of science today. Yet, it remains not only widespread, but naturalized as a fact in popular culture. I like to compare it, actually, to a pernicious biological species introduced into a new environment, because the warfare thesis has proven difficult to eradicate despite the efforts of the scholars best qualified for the task. And this recent book, it calls it the idea that wouldn't die. Well, historians identify two late 19th century books as the conflict thesis's chief vectors. John William Draper's A History of the Conflict Between Religion and Science, and Andrew Dixon White's A History of the Warfare of Science with Theology in Christendom. Well, many historians before my time have already pointed out and refuted the melodramatized history and dubious, that's a generous word, facts upon which these books rest. So I'm not going to spend much time on that because basically it's like shooting fish in a barrel. I'll give you a couple examples of it later on in the talk that will illustrate it. What I want to concentrate more on are the origins and motivations behind Draper and White's notions and how they were perpetuated through the 20th century and into the 21st. So let's look at these books and their authors. Well, I would not be entirely incorrect to say that the war between science and religion began just a few blocks from here on December 1869, because that is when Andrew Dixon White first aired his warfare rhetoric in a lecture entitled The Battlefields of Science at Cooper Union. The text was published in the New York Daily Tribune, and shorter accounts appeared elsewhere. He then published an expanded form as The Warfare of Science in Popular Science Monthly, and then as a slim volume. Then from 1885 to 1895, he provided Popular Science Monthly, I'll come back to that journal later, with 25 articles, all entitled New Chapters in the Warfare of Science. He then cobbled these articles together in 1896 into the ponderous and very dull two-volume, A History of the Warfare Between Science and Theology in Christendom. Well, historians have long recognized that White's warfare was a response to criticism he received during his work to found Cornell University as a non-sectarian university. However, this masks a key part of the story, because the golden apple of discord for White's warfare was the Land Grant Act of 1862. To refresh your memories, this law gave federal land to each state for financing colleges. Choosing among many claims from competing colleges, the New York legislature voted in 1863 that its share would go to a small college called People's College. But in order to receive the funds, the college had to meet certain baseline progress, which they failed to do. So the legislature reconsidered the matter, took the funds back, and proposed splitting the funds between two New York colleges. Well, at just this time, White was elected to the New York Senate, and he killed the bill, proposing that the funds should be used instead to found a new college. Well, then White, eventually in concert with another senator by the name of Ezra Cornell, introduced a bill to this effect. Unsurprisingly, once it looked like the funds were up for grabs again, every college in the state was clamoring to get their share. And all of them were denominational, as was then the norm for American colleges. Well, after contentious debate, legal maneuvering, and a lot of backroom horse trading, the White-Cornell bill passed the state assembly in 1865. Well, following such dealings, it's easy to see why the disgruntled losers would continue to voice their criticisms and thereafter harbor suspicions of impropriety. When one of the senators who introduced this bill left the Senate to become the college's first president, and the other one had it named after him and obtained exclusive control over the finances from the sale of the land. To what extent religious sectarianism played any significant role in the squabbling over federal funds is unclear. It's very unlikely that White was accurate in attributing it to sectarian zealotry against non-sectarian Cornell University. To be honest, no historian has ever found the criticism he claims he was constantly getting. We can't find it. In short, White's warfare model for science and religion resulted from personal issues and a strongly vindictive personality. One of his friends referred to this personality when he said he was in the habit of using a trip hammer to kill a flea. He confected the warfare model in a response to personal criticism and retailored historical events to fit it. And a contemporaneous response to his book now appears to have been substantially correct in calling it, and I quote, "an indiscriminate and uncritical agglomeration of facts brought together for the support of a thoroughly one-sided and fatally misleading proposition. A piece of special pleading like this was not worth writing." The facts White presents are almost entirely fictional or twisted in misleading ways. I'll come back with an example in a minute. What remains difficult to fathom, and this I've puzzled over for years, is how is it that White, a professor of history, a president of the American Historical Association, justified to himself a grotesque and dishonest abuse of historical source material? Did he believe, lawyer and politician-like, that historical accuracy could be legitimately subjugated to the goal of winning an argument at hand? I mean, this is the original alternative facts guy. Well, in contrast to White's political motivation, John William Draper's salvo is actually more interesting because it rests on a philosophical basis, even though his historical evidence is no less confected. Draper built up a position that he believed explained all of both science and history and humanity in lengthy books that preceded his conflict between religion and science. So a little bit about Draper. He was born in England, the son of a Methodist minister, immigrated to the United States in 1832, took up a job as a professor, first at Hampton-Sydney College, and in 1839 as a professor of chemistry and then of physiology at NYU. In 1876, he became, to my shame as a chemist, the first president of the American Chemical Society. Well, Draper's thought can be characterized very simply, an obsession, a very unhealthy obsession, with law. Throughout the 1840s, 50s, and 60s, he moved sequentially from the inanimate world of astronomy and physics through plant, animal, and human physiology to human civilization to argue that all life and development are governed entirely by an impersonal, inescapable law that he called the universal law of development. The constant refrain throughout his works on plant, animal, and human physiology is that external influences, particularly climate, cause metamorphoses of the human body and thence of the human society. Once he reached human societies, he began writing history as a means of proving his belief. First, the intellectual development of Europe. And then in 1865, the end of the Civil War gave him the opportunity to demonstrate his principles by arguing that the war was the inescapable effect of physiological factors resulting from his universal law. In short, he claimed that the different climates of North and South caused a metamorphosis of their inhabitants into different types, which then came into conflict for supremacy. Had there been more North-South travel in the 1850s, he concludes, quote, the Civil War would not have happened.
Really?
So his suggestion is to prevent it happening again, because it will, because the climate is still different, we have to build more railroads going North-South to mix up the peoples. I'm really not making this up. Now, if this sounds rather cartoonish to you, you are not alone. One often wishes to know where Draper obtained the innumerable facts and figures he so confidently asserts, and from which he draws such dazzlingly arbitrary and often contradictory conclusions. But wait, it gets worse. His 1874 conflict between religion and science continues this obsession with his supposed law, but adds a melodramatic, in fact, often hysterical tone. In fact, when I teach my science and religion classes at Hopkins, I often try every year, I never learn, every year I try to find some reading out of Draper that I could give to the students that wouldn't send them into giggles, because it's so over the top. But I've never succeeded. Its vitriolic fulminations are not turned against religion in general, but specifically against Catholicism. Indeed, the work is little more than an anti-Catholic rant. Draper considers, actually, Protestantism to be the, quote, twin sister of science, such that any persecution of science by Protestants comes solely from, and I quote again, an incomplete emancipation from Catholicism. He calls Islam the Southern Reformation carried out by a people ever benevolent to science and progress, while Catholicism is the brutal enemy of science, progress, and human civilization. Thank you very much. Roman Christianity and science are recognized by their respective adherents as being absolutely incompatible. They cannot exist together. Mankind must make its choice. It cannot have both. Recognized by their respective adherents? Are you meaning to tell me that there were actually no Catholic scientists in 1874? I find that hard to believe. Well, any attempt at an analysis of history is overwhelmed by inflammatory rhetoric built upon cherry-picked, contorted, and simply fabricated facts. Well, his hysterical, rabid anti-Catholicism actually rests on three factors that are worth mentioning. The first is the contemporaneous American panic over Catholic immigration. Draper, apparently forgetting that he himself was an immigrant, often referred to, quote, the insidious agency of immigration and the dangers of a hybrid population. How good to know we've gotten over that in the 21st century. He remarks that Irish and other Catholic immigrants keep regions where they settle, quote, in a lower intellectual state. Well, second, there's Draper's family history. Always get back to the personal eventually. Draper's father, conversion to Methodism, caused him to be ostracized by the rest of the Draper family, which was, as you guessed it, Catholic. Draper's sister Elizabeth, who came with him to America, converted to Catholicism while in America, which led to Draper throwing her out of the house. Third, papal declarations in 1864 and 1870 helped drive Draper over the edge. In 1864, Pius IX issued a syllabus of errors, listing philosophical positions that were considered erroneous, such as absolute rationalism and the denial of God's action in the world. two things that were deeply embedded in Draper's metaphysics. In 1870, the First Vatican Council spoke out against materialism, defined the notion of papal infallibility, reasserted the role of faith in human life and understanding, defended Christian education, and emphasized the role that religion should play in governing and guiding society. Well, Draper saw these statements as challenges to his deterministic universal law of development. Now, of course, Draper completely ignored the context in which these were made, as well as Pius IX's noteworthy embrace of new science and technology. For example, Pius IX reestablished the Accademia dei Lincei, now known as the Pontifical Academy of Sciences. And here's something that I discovered rather recently that I need to chase down that I just haven't done yet. Draper was actually elected a fellow of the Pontifical Academy of Sciences. How? Why did he never mention this? Very curious. All right, now Draper might well have imagined that his attacks could finish off the Catholic Church, which was at the time deeply shaken by the contemporaneous seizure of Rome and papal lands, the virtual imprisonment of the Pope in the Vatican, and the forced secularization or dispersal of Italian religious institutions. Now, one thing I have to emphasize here, and I think this is one of the more interesting points about Draper, in fact, why I think he's so much more interesting than White, is it would be wrong to see him as the prototype of an anti-religious scientist. He's not. Instead, his conflict implicitly promotes a religion of his own devising, with a theology opposed to Christianity, opposed to Catholicism especially. Draper's theology derives from his metaphysical assumption of an all-encompassing, immutable nature of laws. Laws that forbid God from ever intervening in the world. And thus, consequently, what he's doing, he's actually deifying his own universal law of development, because it's really what's controlling everything. We don't even have free will. He talks about how we can't do anything to change our situation. We just have to live with the way things are. Thus, the divinity of Christ and all miracles are out, and he praises what he calls the fatalism of the Arabs as insightful resignation to the absolutism of impersonal law. His hero and religious teacher is Averroes, the 12th century Islamic philosopher Ibn Rushd, or rather, a caricature of Averroes. You know, he caricatures so much. His ideas about climate causing changes in human, animal, and plant physiology is this sort of weird, twisted echo of 18th century Buffon and Lamarck, but it's not done right. And what he says about Averroes isn't right either. And I just would like to know what books he used. Now, I can be really snarky and say, well, he was an Englishman, and these books perhaps were written in French that he thought he could read and really couldn't very well, but that's just snark. Thank you for permitting me to do that. I kind of like it. So he defends the Averroistic doctrine of the emanation, unicity, and absorption of the soul. Averroes says that we all share the same soul. It's emitted from God and then reabsorbed into God at death. He defends this doctrine by appealing to the conservation of force. He fulminates against Vatican I because he interprets it as a specific condemnation of Averroes, which I don't think the people there had any thought of, and reduces the entire activity of the Spanish Inquisition to the suppression of Averroistic ideas, which he equates entirely one-to-one correspondence with scientific ideas. So in short, Draper champions a deterministic, pantheistic, pseudo-averroistic religion as the one true faith. And therefore, his book is not really about a conflict between science and religion, but about a conflict between Draper's self-made religion and all others, especially Catholicism. Draper's hysterical rhetoric and attacks on the Pope, and rather off-kilter adulation of Islam, were lampooned in this wonderful cartoon as soon as the book was published. It's too small for you to read down at the bottom, but it comes with a cute little bit of doggerel. Now by the holy prophet's beard the Paynim draper cries, and flourishes his scimitar before St. Peter's eyes. 'Tis I who am infallible, as all the world doth know. By science bright and Islam's might, 'tis I who tell thee so. Well, again, reviewers panned the book. A more hasty, pretentious, and incorrect work claiming the title of history has seldom fallen into our hands, wrote Scribner's Monthly, finding the book, quote, swarming with statements either positively erroneous or put in such a form as to be misleading. Guess what this did to dampen the public enthusiasm for the book? Absolutely nothing. It became a bestseller. It was almost immediately translated into multiple languages and outsold every other book in the scientific series it was published as a part of. In fact, it is still in print today. The champion of both Draper's book and White's was this man, the publisher Edward L. Yeomans. Yeomans commissioned Draper to write The Conflict, and he published White's multiple articles in his Popular Science Monthly. Gleeful over the money that Draper's book was raking in, Yeomans asserted that any criticism of it came, I quote, only from the outside sects, Jews, Unitarians, and Catholics, whom the Orthodox repudiate as knowing nothing of true religion. Thanks. Well, despite the historical bankruptcy of both books, they have set the tone for popular ideas about science and religion down to our own day. But I hope some of you are saying, wait a minute, I've never heard of these books. Well, how many of you have ever heard of these books before? How many of you have ever read them? Okay. Well, you don't need to have read them for them to have an effect on you, because their claims have become fully integrated into popular culture. Now I'll ask you another question. How many of you at some point in your lives have been told, taught, or whatever, that before Columbus people thought the earth was flat? All right. Where did that come from? These books. It's a complete lie. From the time of Aristotle, from before the time of Aristotle, nobody in the West ever questioned the shape of the earth. Period. If there's one thing, you could put it on my tombstone as, you know, as a historian of science, if I can just get people to understand that people knew that the earth was spherical from the time of the ancient Greeks, period. Even Roman coins have a spherical earth minted on them, okay? It comes out of this book. Now, you might say, why did they think this? Okay, well, let's go to Draper's book. There's this long passage, pages and pages of stuff about, Columbus being ridiculed by the theologians at Salamanca who were quoting biblical passages at him. Actually, it goes the other way around. The theologians at Salamanca knew exactly how big the earth was and knew he would have to cross the Pacific Ocean as well as the, you know, they knew the size. They knew he'd never make it alive. Columbus used a bad measure of the size of the earth. Wrong by the width of the Pacific Ocean, by the way. He actually gives you a footnote. It says, Irving, Life of Columbus. Irving? Irving who? Oh, do a little research. Always check your footnotes. It's Washington Irving of Headless Horseman fame who wrote a fictional account of Columbus that these two, dare I say, bozos, used as historical fact. And that is why all of you who raised your hands were told at some point that people before Columbus thought the earth was flat. Okay. So you can see how this stuff gets into culture. White is just as bad. How many of you were ever taught at some point that the Catholic Church forbade human dissection? Okay, that one's not as popular. A few of you, okay? That one's not as popular. You know why that's not as popular? Because that comes out of White's book, rather than Draper, and his was not as popular. Where that comes from is White takes a quotation out of the 24th book of St. Augustine's On the City of God, where he talks about, he says something like, oh, you know, we are reviled by a dead body and opening it up. But if we were to do that and see the magnificent framework of veins and nerves, we would be astonished at the complexity of the natural world and of God's creativity. Instead, Draper just takes that quotation and he chops it in half and leaves only the part where it says, we're reviled by dead bodies, and says, oh, well, see? And the fact of the matter is that if you were getting a medical degree, by the end of the 13th century, you had to be present at least one human dissection by 1300. The problem that there are so few dissections in the, now I'm giving a history of science lecture, I'm sorry. I haven't taught my history of science class in a year or so, so I have all this that I need to get out of my system. The bodies that were dissected had to be executed criminals that did not have family in the area. They had to be executed foreigners, basically. No one would come to claim the body, and so they could be used for dissection. And you don't get that many executed foreigners to have enough for all the medical schools to do a dissection. All right. Fine. Okay, let's step back for a bit. I've told you about these two guys. Now let's think about myths for a moment. In order for a myth to survive, it must play some important role and have persons who need to repeat it. So in the late 19th century, Draper reinforced American racism against Catholic immigrants. Both Draper and White's narratives reinforced 19th century ideas of progress, of the emergence of a new age made possible through science and technology. In Europe, their books, particularly Draper's, became manifestos for political secularizers, legitimizing plans for secularized government and justifying the violent seizure of property and power held by the clergy. And this was perhaps nowhere more evident than in Italy, where Rome and the rest of the papal lands had just been seized and the Pope virtually imprisoned in the Vatican. Even shamefully, I must admit, some historians of science, no names please, as late as the 1970s, kept using Draper and White's book in the context of the now rejected triumphalist narrative of science and technology. The myth of an eternal struggle, a Manichaean struggle between science and religion, furthermore operates as an origin myth for modern science and lays the foundation for setting up science as a religion of its own. Draper and White's books implicitly borrow imagery from the history of religion by creating a litany of martyrs and a hagiography of oppressed visionaries. They recast scientists as prophets and priests who suffered to spread a gospel of science against the ignorance of the pagans, that is, the old priesthood of religion. And in fact, what I find in trying to explain this, it's the social dynamics of folklore that explain why these books have become so popular and stayed so popular, rather than any kind of, you know, rigidly rational historical argument. The origin myth of science also spoke to concerns about the social status and authority of the newly professionalizing scientists of late 19th century. By arguing that scientists had defeated religionists at every turn, it followed naturally that scientists had rightly displaced religionists and taken to themselves their cultural position of authority. And that means that the myth lent and continues to lend to this day an identity, a pedigree, and a position to scientists. Hence it is that many scientists and science writers continue to use and to defend the myths of Draper and White, which is one reason why I have personally found that there have been many scientists who are extremely agitated by historians who point out the falsity of the myth. You're essentially undercutting the ground on which they found their own identities. But there's more. The concept of an inherent incompatibility of science and religion and the struggle for socio-political authority was perpetuated by a surprising cast of characters in the 20th century. Chief among these were what are called the techno-utopianists, those who believed that the social, political, and moral systems of the past had to be replaced with scientific thinking and technology for reformulating society. We find in these early techno-utopists all the seeds of the modern-day scientism, followers of scientism, that science answers all questions whatsoever. For most of them, their views included a socialist politics and materialist ideology, a vision of a world government, and the abolition of religion as a relic of the past and a stumbling block for the future. A key member of these techno-utopianists was H.G. Wells. Well, today you may think of him primarily as a science fiction writer, based on the books he wrote in the 1890s, Invisible Man, War of the Worlds, Time Machine. But his post-war, post-World War I writings were far more influential in their own day. His best-selling work was his Outline of History, published in 1919, that is reputed to be the best-selling history book of all time. Again, you've probably never read it or heard of it. Wells' book follows an oversimplifying reductionist strategy like Draper's, and repeatedly cast religion, Christianity in particular, as the enemy of human progress. Wells's choice of historical episodes and his language suggests that Draper and White were in fact his major sources. He built his narrative upon a stark division between science, technology, and progress on the one side, and religion on the other. Again, professional historians, nobody ever listens to us. They rejected the work, but it still became a worldwide bestseller in multiple languages. In 1923, he published Men Like Gods, about a utopian world where science flourishes and religion has died. And in 1933, The Shape of Things to Come. If you've ever seen any of the movie versions of it, they have almost no relationship to the book, because the book tells of a world war followed by a plague that wipes out most of humanity. Good start. A world government is then set up, which first eliminates Islam by blowing up all the mosques, save a handful that have architectural value. The Pope and the Catholic hierarchy are then invited to a meeting where they are gassed to death. Finally, the world government is overthrown and a worldwide council of scientists builds a utopian society. Now, one might see this as a horrific dystopic vision, but the real horror is that it seems to be what Wells actually advocated. Utopia would emerge, according to Wells and his like-minded colleagues, when scientists put themselves unopposed at the head of the table and a religion, which they perceive as their rival, is abolished. Well, throughout the 1920s, 30s, 40s, and 50s, like-minded voices from the sciences continued the Draper-White story. Just one example, J.B.S. Haldane, very successful science popularizer, X-ray crystallographer. If you have ever heard the term primordial soup, he invented it. Really, really very good, I mean, honestly, a very clever popularizer. However, he was a physiologist, a materialist, evolutionary biologist, and propagandist for the Soviet Union. Here he is haranguing a political crowd, and often appeared on the new BBC radio broadcast about popularizing science. I haven't time to explore it tonight, but such activities of the early and mid-20th century actually continue in a very clear line of descent to the present-day prophets of scientism, like Dawkins and Hitchens and all the rest of them. I often wondered why so many of the sort of very loud proponents of scientism, of anti-religious scientism, are actually British. And this is actually, I think, the reason that they were immersed as children, as adolescents, in the kind of these radio broadcasts from the BBC and this other, the other kind of popularization that was going on in England at the time. I think that's the only explanation that at least is satisfying for me at the moment, until someone tells me something better. Well, having now returned to the present day, I need to point to one more contributing factor, one that I hinted at the start of my talk when I mentioned needless theological missteps. Let's not just blame the scientists on this one. I refer to a particular subset of theology, I would say bad theology, that bears a part of the blame for the persistence of the warfare model and that is integral to much of the conflict we read about today. Ironically, this bad theology started out as a way to integrate science and religion, often proposed by scientists themselves, and used to justify the pursuit of science by highlighting its support for religion. What I have in mind is the God of the Gaps problem, namely the invocation of direct divine action to fill in the gaps in our explanation of natural events. The problem is, of course, that the resorts to God's action is a consequence of our limited knowledge, and therefore as scientific knowledge increases, the gaps become filled with natural explanations, and God, hence religion, is successively squeezed out. Therefore, to the untrained observer, it looks as if advances in science and the understanding of material laws replace religion, exactly what Draper, White, Wells, and the others said would and should happen. Classic example for you. It comes from Isaac Newton. In material he gave to this man, Richard Bentley, who is was an Anglican priest, for his Boyle lectures of 1692 and 1693. These lectures were given, as you can see at the top, was to confute atheism. So here is an example of using science against what the English at the time thought was a rising tide of atheism. Everyone was talking about the atheists, but no one ever found one or could point to one. It was sort of, the terrorist behind the bushes. Newton had observed that the orbital velocities of the planets Jupiter and Saturn were changing. One planet was speeding up while the other one was slowing down. If that change continued, he extrapolated, our solar system would become unstable. But since the system has remained stable, God must intervene from time to time to set the system right. Well, there are a number of problems with this. Not only does the argument make God seem an incompetent workman who couldn't figure out how to design a stable solar system, but 70 years later, Simon Laplace discovered how the system corrects itself by gravitational action. So God had one fewer thing to do. The same issue bedevils the argument from design, namely that complex structures like the eye and the hand had to have a direct and immediate designer, i.e. God, and thus prove his existence. This was very popular in the 18th century and into the 19th century. This is the most famous example of it by William Paley, called Natural Theology, Evidences of the Existence and Attributes of the Deity Collected from the Appearances of Nature. All sorts of things to talk about design as proof of God's existence. Unfortunately, this meant that throughout the 19th century, particularly in Anglophone countries, particularly in Northern European, which is my way of saying Protestant countries, this became virtually the only theological argument in favor of religion. So what happens? Along comes Mr. Darwin and explains why things are designed the way they are on the basis of natural laws. So now, once again, the discovery of evolution, natural selection, and genetics show that God has one fewer thing to do. Religion picked the wrong horse. And so a natural extrapolation would be that God is unnecessary and religion always gets it wrong. Of course, this ignores the fact that many of the gaps from which God was squeezed out were closed by religious believers. A couple of quick examples of the monk Gregor Mendel for genetics, the priest Georges Lemaître for Big Bang cosmology. The point is that the God of the Gaps arguments were a bad move from the beginning. It was in large measure, as I said, a move in England to combat what they believed was a rising tide of atheism. Now, don't get me wrong. Wonder at the natural world can certainly intensify devotion in the believer and urge one onwards towards discovering more about the world. That's a kind of natural theology that works. But the problem is when it becomes a theological argument, when it's virtually your only theological argument, because in fact, it's a very weak one. It didn't need to be so. Much, not all, of what is perceived today as a conflict between science and religion stems from errors in the assignment of causation that is generally linked to bad theology and bad exegesis. Think of the unnecessary turmoil caused by fundamentalist insistence on special creation instead of evolution, or a young Earth created in a short period rather than an ancient Earth and universe. By the way, a colleague of mine has just written a book, which now the title is out of my head, showing that, this the idea that the Earth is quite young in thousands of years is actually, again, a fairly recent post-Reformation development. That in the Middle Ages, there are lots of examples of people who thought of the Earth as being almost eternal in terms of its, not literally eternal, but a very ancient antiquity. Naive biblical literalism plays a big role, and its origins too date from a relatively recent period. Medieval theologians would not have made either mistake, because they saw calling in direct divine action to explain natural phenomena as an intellectual cop-out. In doing so, those theologians did produce a form of what we call methodological naturalism, namely, that only natural causation counts as a comprehensible, I emphasize the word comprehensible explanation of events. That doesn't mean you can't have miracles, it just means that miracles don't actually explain anything in the normal meaning of the word explain. And that is, that methodology of methodological naturalism lies at the heart of modern science. On the one hand, they expressed reliance on the operation of natural causes, which they saw as powers implanted in creation at the very beginning. Now, given, as you've already heard and should already know, that today is his feast day, I would be remiss if I did not use one of my favorite examples that comes from St. Thomas Aquinas. I'll tell you why I chose this particular image in a minute. In his commentary on Aristotle's Physics, the angelic doctor extends the ancient Greek philosopher's favored metaphor of shipbuilding. Aristotle notes that a ship comes to be only when the inactive matter of wood is suitably arranged into a ship by means of the shipbuilding art that is in the mind of the craftsman. Okay? You understand that? Frankly, this is the way that unsophisticated views of special creation or of design work. The world can't come together on its own without the immediate intervention of a craftsman god, like the ship. Instead, Thomas cleverly observes that Aristotle's metaphor applies only to artificial things, not to natural things. Instead, he argues, God so created the world that in the workings of nature, it is as if the shipbuilding art were implanted in the wood such that the timbers assemble themselves into a ship. It's a marvelous image. You know, you sort of imagine this sort of Harry Potter sort of thing where the trees cut themselves down and make themselves into lumber and make a ship. But what he's talking about is that by the very act of creation, there are causes implanted in the natural world that are only maintained in existence. And those natural causes are what we use to explain natural phenomena and how nature actually works. Thus, in conclusion, I'm trying to make two points. First, the eternal conflict between science and faith described by Draper and White was a product of their own imaginations, guided by their personal, political, and metaphysical agendas. It did not exist when or as they claimed. But their narratives and the divisions they produce have provided, I think, a model for what later emerged as conflicts down to our own day. Oh, why did I didn't mention why I chose this one. Remember I said that Draper was essentially a following a Veroese or a caricature of a Veroese? This guy lying on the ground is a Veroese. This is actually titled The Triumph of St. Thomas Aquinas over a Veroese. So there he is, defeated. Where was I? Right. The second thing I wanted to mention is that the conflict that we do see in the media every day is the result not only of the patterns woven into popular culture by the Draper-White narratives, but also of bad apologetic and theological choices. That is, a misguided reliance on natural theology and a God of the gaps type arguments, and the erosion of methodological naturalism, and of course, of informed biblical exegesis. These would unnecessarily bring, or rather seem to bring, science and Christianity into conflict. The consequent problems, of course, became far worse with the rise of fundamentalism in early 20th century America, and its yet more reprehensible forms of the early 21st. But That is another story, and one that I don't have time to talk about this evening. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.